You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is the wonderful Jarlath Reagan, a fabulous Irish comic who's just recently moved over to the UK with his fabulous wife and tiny family. And he's one of the genuinely nicest men in comedy. You hear that not a lot. Do you hear it a little bit about certain comedians, but Jarlath is the... If there was a race to find the nicest man in comedy, Jarlath would stand aside to let someone else win. This is the fabulous Jarlath Reagan. I mean, we're recording this now, sitting in your charming house, and I've just met your fabulous wife and your brilliant son. And the first thing, I think, coming into these surroundings, and you know part of why I like, if I can, recording where people write or where people work, part of it is just a vicarious, nosy sort of thrill. But walking in here, the first thing that hits me is just like, oh, how good is your life?
It's all rented in it.
Yeah, yeah. not because it's expensive or glamorous, but because it's kind of... small and humble and happy. And you know, I think when I was watching back some of your stuff, obviously we gigged together a fair bit in the last few years, or a few times,
didn't
we?
Yeah.
And I was watching back to some of your stuff on YouTube to sort of kickstart my memory, and you're really nice. You're a really nice guy, and that's a criticism that can sound critical, and that's often levelled at me. People go, "Oh, Goldsmith's ever so nice, isn't it?" Michael Legg's always trying to make me.
I never understood how it's a criticism. I mean, I've heard, I remember a promoter saying to me that, you know, and I get it all the time. I get nice all the time, rubbing my eyes. Like anybody trying to do this, you're yourself, you try and be as real as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I do value nice. I value it a lot.
Okay.
I think much more than a lot of people would. I think that that whole thing of it's nice to be nice is really important.
Sure.
Like in this world of absolute cutthroat nonsense, people clambering over each other to get to things.
Sure.
That's not to say that I intentionally go out there and go, I'm gonna be a nice
no,
guy.
No, but do you think it's an honest, your stand-up persona is an honest reflection of who you are as a person?
Yeah, well, I would say that it's definitely me. Yeah, no question about it. It's definitely me. But, you know, it never is finished, is it? Like, you can never say, that's that. Like, you've seen those couple of bits on YouTube. There's probably two decent videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
Of sets that were fucking pared down and edited and chopped.
Sure, sure.
When in the moment... it's much, much looser and freer and a bit more, there probably is a bit more darkness to it because I've probably come through a lot more since those times. And probably it's something that young comics get leveled at them as well, as like, you're 23 years old, you've never lived through any hardship.
Sure.
Probably have now.
Yeah.
And since we worked together a couple of years back.
Yes, okay.
Probably been through that and things have changed quite a bit.
Okay.
So, but I value nice, but I don't think that it's the defining thing.
Sure.
Anyway,
do you think in terms of the comedy industry, which is replete with people who are either edgy or difficult, or are pretending to be edgy and you know, deliberately being difficult, do you think that nice guys finish last in the comedy industry?
I don't know. You see, when's the finish is the question.
Oh, nice. Philosophical. Like it? Yeah.
When's it over?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe nice guys don't get to the top of the queue as quickly.
Sure.
But they do get there. I had this conversation with a lot of comics where a lot of just, and a lot of friends where I'm like, the people at the top of this industry, like in terms of the individuals, you can really only think of two pricks.
Yeah, right.
Majority of the guys at the very, very top.
Sure.
Like, I'm talking, like, you know who you're talking about. Anyone that you've met that's properly, like, well, you can't really argue with Adam Sandler.
Sure.
Or, say, Ed Byrne and Darrow Breen would be, like, contemporary examples of Irish guys that have done it. Good guys. There's two pricks we can all think of.
Yeah.
And the listener is probably thinking of them too because they've heard the stories of them being dicks.
Sure.
So nice guys finishing last is a myth to me because where are all the examples of the dicks finishing first?
Yes, okay.
There really aren't that many.
Okay.
I really don't think there are.
I had a friendly argument in a car with a bunch of comics in Monte Carlo or somewhere like that. I'm doing Ollie Atkinson's Riviera gigs.
Wow.
I was out there with JJ.
Quite a place drop there.
Yeah. Yeah, clang. Monte Carlo.
Place drop is nearly worse than a name drop.
The gigs were fun, didn't pay a huge amount, and the company was very good fun. But the key thing was to be able to say you'd been to Monte Carlo. Probably Ollie will email me.
Say Monte Carlo
and tell me
to picture you in a sports car. Don't know why.
Yeah. That did not happen. But we had this friendly discussion in the car, whereby I was the only person arguing the position that nice guys don't finish last. And they were going, yes, they do. Yeah, they obviously do. If you hear about an opportunity and you tell it to all your friends, then you're less likely to get it than if you keep it secret and go for it yourself. And I ended up, the only line of argument that I could pursue, that I could maybe kind of force a stalemate on, was that nice guys have a different perspective of what it means to win.
Hmm.
Or what it means to finish. And it's just interesting to me that you have a similar sort of thing.
The first reaction.
Well, what do we mean by finish?
Yeah. And also, what's first?
Yeah.
Like, where is first place? Like, yeah, nice guys probably do finish last if first place is, you know, gigging regularly or breaking into the store.
Mm.
You know, a nice guy will hold back and disappear and not, you know.
And wait to be asked rather than put your foot in the door and things like that. Yeah.
Probably won't get in there as quickly. But if the nice guy's really funny, that's why one of the reasons why I love this is because this is just a unique justice in what we do, in that if it tears the roof off, if it is really funny, unique and brilliant,
sure,
it won't finish last. It just won't.
So first things first, I've got a very bunged up nose in this interview. I don't at the moment, but in the interview I have. Sorry about that. Also, we do a little extra bit on the end of this interview, which is weird. It sounds a bit different because we did it on Skype. We recorded it over Skype quite well, I thought. It took me ages to learn how to do it. But the upshot is my nose is a little healthier sounding at that bit. So this is great. Really, really interesting.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Interview, there's some serious stuff on here as well. We're going to talk about Jarless experiences of writing a show about an ongoing near tragic event, the moment when he risked losing his wife and child, and about how it feels to be trying to make something funny whilst it still hurts. Lots of people can relate to that, I think, in terms of that principle, if not those exact circumstances. So there's some weighty stuff in here as well. It's not just the two of us being nice at each other. If you've not seen Jarlath, I urge you to catch him out. He's got a couple of videos on YouTube. He's absolutely brilliant live.
And there's some really interesting stuff, particularly towards the end, about the humbling experience of moving to a new country and having to start all over again. So really, really fascinating episode. We'll get right back into it. Just one little announcement, really, about Edinburgh, the live show. About Edinburgh, I'm looking down my list of things to say. Sorry, that's like when I'm on the phone to my girlfriend. And she can tell that I'm not 100% focused. Two things to say. The first is I'm still not asking you for money, guys. I don't have a donate button or anything like that. So the only payments I need is if you just share your favourite episode with a friend. Choose your favourite one. Email them a link to the episode. You can find it on the SoundCloud page or you can find it on iTunes. Just pick an episode. Think of an episode that's particularly meant something to you. Picture it in your head now. Are you doing it? Picture it now. Eyes on the road. Picture that episode and then think of someone who you think would get something out of that episode in the same way that you did, who isn't aware of the podcast. Make them aware of the podcast. That's all I ask. Thank you for that. That's my equivalent of a little sponsorship blurb. Oh, and I know I said two things. I'll say this very quickly. I have been absolutely fascinated by the Dan Carlin's Common Sense podcast. He's a libertarian, non-partisan. You know, sometimes I like to recommend other podcasts on the show, notably Matt Ford's podcast, The Political Party, is excellent. Obviously, there's brilliant people like Pappy's Flatshare Slamdown. Richard Herring doesn't need any help from me advertising. But at the moment, I'm really turned on to Dan Carlin's Common Sense. It's like an American, if you're interested in American politics or politics in general, it's like a really interesting political commentary about all sorts of stuff. There's a great episode on North Korea and why Dan believes them not really to be that much of a threat. That was all recorded when that was going off. So that's just other stuff, other recommendations. You're all pod people. You should know about good pods. So the last thing was the guests for the Edinburgh show coming up on the Comedian's Comedian Live from the 14th of August. So make a note of these. The tickets are on sale now. And five of these seven names I'm going to tell you are available to the public. Because obviously as soon as the name goes out, then people can start buying tickets for that specific show. Two of them are only available to you here and now, so get on them quick because they're definitely going to sell out and I want super fans like you guys to be in the room. So on the 14th, Will Franken. Now, I don't know if many of you all heard of Will Franken. I only heard of him last year at Edinburgh. He's an American comic. He's a one-man sketch show. Just hundreds and hundreds of sketches and characters. It's almost like... you know Jigsaw? You know Jigsaw, Dan Antopolsky, Nat Lutzimer and Tom Crane? They do hundreds and hundreds of little tiny sketches. He's kind of like that, but in one guy, and he'll just morph from one into the other. His opening sketch from last year's Edinburgh show was one of the funniest things I saw at that entire festival. It was so kind of meta and head-squeezing, and you sort of worked out... He was doing this thing where he was kind of inflicting... he was pretending that someone in the audience was part of the sketch and had forgotten their line. It was such a simple concept, done so well. Will Franken up with a brand new show. He's going to be on the 14th of August. On the 15th of August, you don't need me to tell you anything about this guy. It's Tim Vine. That's going to be an incredible chat with just a master of comedy. And the same on the 16th, Ed Byrne. Absolutely superb, Ed Byrne. We'll be talking to him in great detail. As with the 17th, Susan Kalman. Susan Kalman might not be known to some of you in the UK. She's massive in Scotland. She's Fred Macaulay's assistant on lots of his shows. She's done loads and loads of Edinburgh Hours herself, and she is snappy and quick-witted and just has real comedy bones. On the 18th, I don't know who it is yet. We've not booked it yet. So that's a little mystery guest you go for someone cool on the 18th. Now, to the first... Okay, these three I'll do in a row. You already know that on the 20th, it's Sarah Millican. Sarah Millican is the first comic to return to ComCom Pod. She's going to come and do a live show. It'll definitely sell out. Get in quick. But on the 19th and on the 21st, and please don't make these available to the public. These are just for you for now. I'm so stoked about both of these. On the 19th, Al Murray. We've got him for an hour. He's all mine. On the 21st... Rob Delaney. Rob Delaney, if you follow Twitter, you'll know who Rob Delaney is. He's the biggest comic on Twitter in the US, predominantly because he uses it for its own thing and he's funny in his own way. He's kind of carved out his own way, his own... Not only does he have like a comedy persona in stand-up, he has a similar but different, very, very deft, very subtle persona on. Well, I say subtle. It's subtly different. It's not very subtle a persona per se. That's on Twitter. So he's massive on that. You must come and see those. Al Murray on the 19th, Rob Delaney on the 21st, and of course Sarah Millick on the 20th. No one knows about Al Murray and Rob Delaney yet, so don't tell them. Just tell your mates. Tell people you like, but don't kind of put it anywhere public just yet. Email me, info@comedianscomedian.com, if you have any questions, anything you would like to ask those people. We should open the batting now. I think I'm going to ask, as well as in the room, asking for questions from the audience. When I do those shows, I'm going to ask one listener question. So we'll do a competition as to what that listener question is going to be. info@comedianscomedian.com. In the subject line, put something like, just put the word questions. And if you have specific questions for those specific guests I've mentioned, then I will pick the best one, the most intriguing, the most incisive question, and ask away. So ask anything. Tweet me @ComComPod, and that is enough chat for now. Let's get back to the fabulous Jarlath Reagan.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So let's just go into that. And that was, you were a graphic designer before you were a comic. Had you tried comedy at the time? What was, just in a potted history, yeah, what was, I guess, your first couple of steps?
I guess graphic design kind of, and me being a graphic designer, is kind of a thing that gets written down on a press mm-hmm. release because it's easy to swallow. The more complicated origin story is that I always stood up in front of people. As far as back as I can remember, I always looked for the opportunity in school mm-hmm. or in college to stand up in front of people and do the speech. Mm-hmm. And then I always used what was intended to be a serious speech to crowbar in jokes or try and flip it on its head mm-hmm. and make the crowd laugh. Mm-hmm. That was what I always did. And so I wound up doing debating as a result because of the best possible way to do it and the easiest way to do it in a place and a time where there was no comedy clubs.
Sure.
And by the time I got to college, comedians were kind of coming in and out okay. and doing things. And by the end of college, it was obvious to me that that's what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And your parents leaning on you to be safe and to do mm-hmm. what's right, and you know, they just want you to be safe.
Yeah.
People who criticize their parents, I never understand it. They just want you to be safe. They wanted me to get a safe job. I did.
Okay.
And that was an account executive okay. in a graphic design company.
Oh, I understand. Okay.
So I managed the jobs.
Yeah.
Somebody comes in, they ask for a thing. Mm-hmm. Want to design a website. They ask me, I take it to the studio and I tell them what they want. I yeah. go back to the client and bring them the thing, and then they go, well, we don't like it.
Yeah.
I go, well, I don't know anything about graphics.
Yeah, okay, sure.
So I'll be back with an answer. And it did suck the life out of me for that time. And
okay.
by the time I got let go, the Celtic Tiger in Ireland was beginning to wobble.
Okay.
And the first people.
For the uninitiated, that means the economic
the boom.
Growth.
Yeah,
the
boom. Yeah, we had a massive boom there. And that was beginning to just shake for the first time. There was a question of, uh-oh, hang on, are we not going to sell houses forever?
Yeah.
And that was principally our work was shopping centres and shit like that.
Okay.
And the first person not to be paid was the guy who designed the brochure to sell the thing.
Gotcha.
That was us.
Okay.
So we stopped getting paid. I was the first man out the door. I went home and started looking for other jobs. My wife came home and said, "What are you doing? You have a job. You've been gigging. You've been going around doing stand-up. Just fucking do it." And that was it. That was it. I just did it.
A nice guy, Jonathan Reagan, pushed into it by his wife.
Oh, man. I don't know if that ice guy thing is going to haunt me forever.
Yeah, no. Not necessarily. Hey, listen, stop thinking about that in terms of this, because, you know.
No, I just, I find the nice guy thing has been, it's been around me since, well, when I started, I was doing one-liners, darkish one-liners, huge Hedberg fan, Stephen Wright, Jimmy Carr, loved Dimitri Martin, and there wasn't nice stuff. And then one night they just all crashed and burned. And that I can remember that night in the comedy set, I was sitting down on stage and going, I'm gonna talk now. I'm not gonna just do these lines.
Sure.
And when I started to talk, it started to be nice.
That fascinates me, because I, as I said, I suffer from that myself. I think that I'm thought of as being nice.
I've heard you just discuss this
on
the podcast.
Yeah,
it is really interesting to me.
What? Yeah, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. This will be two nice men telling each other how fascinating they are.
No. The conundrum that we both face.
Yes.
Is, am I trying to make them like me?
Yes.
Or is that it? Is it like that? It's an overpowering urge.
Yes.
If your persona is, hey guys, I'm like one of you. And that is, it's very hard to try new material then in that situation, because you've just urge to please.
Yes. Okay. So that does that. That's what I was going to ask. Let's talk about the urge to please, the urge to be liked, the urge to be approved of. Let's talk about some gigs where that didn't work. How does that feel for you? Because I agree that we're on a similar page here, but let's talk about you, because, you know, well, I'll do my own one at some point.
Gigs where it hasn't worked.
Gigs where it hasn't worked. Just sum up for me. What does that feel like when a nice man that wants people to like him, when a gig bombs, are you experiencing what's going on in your body, what's going on in your mind when that doesn't work, when that feeling of, I want them to like me and they're not liking me?
I have a sicky feeling in my stomach when you bring me back to it.
Okay. And I do a bit as well describing it.
I get the impression from you, Stu, that you don't die much, ever.
Not much.
Let's be honest. How many times have you really died?
Once.
Once.
Really died. Yeah. But then I used to be a street performer, so I can stand there with them not looking at me. I can stand with them just looking at me, and I can...
But that's a similar thing with me.
Yeah.
I've never, like, sent it at pace, diving into the earth, and picked up speed on the way down, the way a character act might.
Yes.
Because of what we do, and because of, I suppose, the skill and muscle that being... the way we are on stage,
it is
more difficult to die in this position,
because
you have an ability to pull it out of the fire. That said, when it's happened, most notably in Mountjoy Prison in Dublin city centre, I could feel it. I could feel the just a left turn. You can feel the room go. And again, it's because of what we do. You're very attuned to this. Are they with me? Because you need them with you to be in these jokes and stories about your life, to be on your side for these jokes to really work, right? So you can feel them going, we're not on this guy's side.
We
know. No, thank you. We see what you're doing.
Yeah.
And we're not falling for it. And what was weird about it, that particular gig in Mountjoy, was these guys wanted to laugh more than anybody. They're not going to get comedy again for another 6 months.
Sure. Oh, man.
Oh, God. I went on the first 5 minutes. Who am I kidding? The first minute was fine.
Yeah.
And then, to quote a friend of mine, I could hear them blinking. It was so quiet.
What?
A silence in this prison, and you could see the wardens looking at me going, guys in there, you know. I told this story on stage, that those guys in there going, I mean, I've made some mistakes in my life, but look at this fucking agent.
Okay, that thing of I needing them to like you to go with the stuff.
Mm.
I look at some other acts jealously and I think it doesn't matter. They don't care whether we like them. The stuff is the stuff.
Yeah.
But I often feel myself like I've got to win them over because once they buy me, this'll work. Not once they buy me, any old shit will work, but once they buy me, they'll go with the stuff.
I live with my wife and my child. I never get to talk about comedy like this. I really don't get to hang out after the clubs.
Sure.
I get to go for pints with guys that much. This is a joy to talk about this first and foremost. When people say what we're... when they look down on that thing of I need them to be on my side for this to happen, I think they miss the point of why getting them on your side allows you to go places that those other guys who go, it doesn't matter if they like me,
sure,
can't go.
Okay.
And they would argue that their thing, and they're right, you know, setting yourself up as an aggressive kind of guy, warts and all. Mm-hmm. You know, you may not have to like me, but this is funny. Patrice O'Neill,
sure,
perfect example.
Sure,
it's truth. You know, this is the truth, whether you like it or not. But winning them over and getting them on side, you can deliver harsh truths to them.
Sure,
from the perspective of somebody who they have warmed to.
Yes, and now, I see.
Listen, yes, I got some bad news for you.
Yeah.
Look at Jerry. I mean, Jerry, first name terms.
Yeah, of course.
Jerry Seinfeld is like my idol. I just think that, you know, and he is a scientist with comedy and how he constructs it. And he doesn't get the credit for the darkness of his stuff.
Mm.
And it is, he's been allowed to go there because of years of winning us over. And now he's able to stand up on stage, much like Cosby, and say, life is shit. All your things are shit. Being out with your friends is shit. And you're going to die. And this is Jerry Seinfeld. What's the deal with?
Sure.
So in some ways, the tables are turning towards it being possible for the nice guy, inverted commas,
yeah,
to be the darkest of all.
Yes. Yes, and there's nothing more frustrating than seeing someone who thinks they're dark, or who thinks they're edgy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've heard this come up on the podcast. It's a pet peeve, isn't it? It's the most generic thing of all, is you just can't handle the truth.
Yeah.
No, it's just not funny.
Sure.
You know, it's that kind of... That's probably more generic than anything, isn't it? Pretending to be a kind of a sage, kind of this modern man wandering the lands telling you the truth when, you know, you're a dime a dozen, you know?
Something I was thinking about on the way over here was the place of comedy in society and how I like to, certainly when I was a street performer, I've got this whole kind of fascination with the idea of the street performer or the, you know, the outsider as some sort of, I mean, I've possibly referred to it before, the kind of the whole warrior poet shtick. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? This feeling that you are not necessarily a special person. Well, maybe you're off the grid, but more that... In society, we need comedians somehow. Mm. We need it. What's your view on that? Because I think a lot of the sort of the edgier acts that we're talking about would say, "Oh yeah, that's definitely what it is." But how do you come at that from the perspective of how do you come at that?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I think we, as a society, we're always going to need our comedians. But I'm coming from a situation where I'm born a stand-up into a boom, like became a stand-up into an economic boom.
Mm.
Clubs everywhere across Ireland. You work 7 nights a week. There was, maybe that's an exaggeration, but there's clubs everywhere.
Sure.
And you're earning a fine living just from the appetite that people had for comedy in a boom. And then things go like heavily sour. You've no idea how bad it's gotten and continues to get there. And then you're kind of woken up to the fact that, oh, wait, comedy is a luxury.
Sure.
To a lot of people, the idea that, you know, we'll spend money on entertainment is, you know, that's informed a little bit of my thought at the moment about this whole, or where's our role in this society, that I've had to leave my country because it's just impossible to live.
Is that why? I was going to sort of talk about the move in a bit, but that's...
Yeah, just impossible to live.
Okay.
Now, that said, it became impossible to live there. It became very possible to live here.
Sure.
I started to get a lot of work here as a result of going to Edinburgh for 7 years. And, you know, I guess I'm kind of in a place, Stu, where I felt a bit like, oh, right, so comedy actually isn't that important to Irish society. And not that I am the representative of comedy, but that I was surplus to requirements, and comics were, and comics continue to move. Ed, Dara, Andrew, all these guys moved here when the Irish economy was fucked before.
Yes.
And now it's happening again. Irish people have always been the country's biggest export. Okay. And now it's just returning to that. Now, to the question of what's our role, I mean, I'm a little bit confused on it at the moment. I think there probably is a place for the comic in everyday life. Everyone needs some laughter at the end of the day. It's just crucial to how you live. But I don't know if I don't know, coming from my situation, if I felt a little bit like, what the fuck is the point? Like, what the fuck am I doing?
Because if it is just entertainment, and it's a luxury item that's entertaining people who can afford to be entertained, that's a very different picture to the idea of a sort of ragged, trousered troubadour who's kind of... I think in another similarity that we have is that you have, and obviously you have a wife and child to support in a way that I don't, but you have... Let me comment this. What do I mean? How important is it to you to have a comfortable life as well as to tell your truths?
See, this probably comes back to the if we can zero back in the question to me and us and what we do, I probably don't think that I'm going on stage and issuing truths.
Sure.
I think that I'm going on stage and I am giving people my perspective on the world. I'm literally telling my story of living, and people empathize with that, and the way in which you make them laugh is literally saying that we're not that different. We're that's probably my truth.
Sure.
And that's maybe the truth of the everyman nice guy comic is
sure
that we aren't that different. I definitely had a sense that English people are very different to Irish people. 3 months here, this Edinburgh show is going to be about, it's just formed. It's just come out as, no, we're actually not that far apart from each other. Is the life of living comfortably, how important is that to that truth? I mean, you're right, the family and your wife and child become... That their comfort becomes more important than yours.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when that happens, you know, comics in their 20s, you know, wearing leather jackets, pointy shoes, and buying nice jeans. I mean, they're their baby.
Yeah.
They themselves.
Yes.
Second, an actual baby and wife arrive in the scene. My comfort's really irrelevant.
Okay.
I don't want to be rich.
No, sure.
I just want them to be happy.
Sure.
It's all like it's so trite, but it is all for them.
Yeah, I think because I'm in the pre-wife and baby stage, but in the last 10 years, I've gone from being a street performer who probably was a bit of a journeyman and saw himself as kind of on this big adventure, and bringing that with me into stand-up, and then looking around in stand-up and going, oh, actually, a fair bit of my income comes from being an entertainer rather than, you know, an entertainer first and foremost, being, you know, looking at corporates. I imagine you do a fair few corporates. You're like I am. You're a very likable, warm, easy to get along with guy. If I was organising an awards ceremony for a gas manufacturer's company, you know, people who made boilers, I'd come to you or me. So I suppose...
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Do you know what I mean? I suppose what I'm getting at
comes back to it. How much does that inform what you write? Is this sellable? Is that what it is?
Yeah, maybe that's part of the question, yes. In that, like, part of you is burning brightly wanting to express yourself.
Yeah.
And part of you is aware that that brightly burning material has to be tempered and manufactured. Into something that's employable, into something that's palatable. And is that a wrench? Is that difficult? Or is it because you and I have always been... We've always been people that enjoy people getting on.
Mm.
Is it actually easier to go, here's the stuff, and the stuff will make you laugh, and that's good enough for me?
Yeah, I think that's what it comes back to. That thing that we mentioned about the justice. That you don't really ever really... I certainly never really think about, oh, well, is this marketable? Is this what people are after at the moment? Is there a niche for this? Never have a thought like that. I think all you think about is what is funny to you at this particular time. And like I say, with the justice, is that like Barry Katz? Do you know Barry Katz?
I don't know.
He's an American stand-up agent who's represented people like Dane Cook.
Sure,
And stuff along the way. He's kind of a weird... character of American comedy. He speaks about this notion that America speaks, and I think that audiences speak. That appreciation for what it is that you find funny, they'll tell you, is that funny, is that worth money? They'll tell you. It's not really up to you to think about it. You just got to do what you do, and they'll let you know. They'll just let you know. I certainly never really think about, will this make money? And probably looking at my Edinburgh shows over the last 6 years, that's probably quite visible if you look down through them.
Have you, you've done seven, you've done
this is my
seven
seventh.
Years. Is that consecutively?
Consecutively.
Or seven consecutive years?
Yeah.
And how has that been? What's that experience like? In terms of the actual process of someone who's done 7 years on the trot, how's your approach changed from year one to year seven?
I suppose the first thing was that in year one I probably didn't write anything down. I went up with an hour of stuff that I had accumulated from the previous 4 years.
Sure.
And of doing it. And, it was very much like, well, these are my jokes. These are the jokes literally tailored together. The following year, I actually went out and tried to engineer something, tried to make stuff happen in my life.
Okay.
To make it, let's have some stuff happen. I'd heard Darrow Breen talk about that. That if ever he's low on material, he goes out and he, books in a balloon ride.
Yeah, I did that once. I did that with a safety, what's it called? CPR course.
It's not a bad idea, because even the process of booking in can provide the material.
Sure.
And the thing that I chose to do was get involved in white collar boxing.
Okay.
So my second year show was about joining white collar boxing and realizing a fear of fighting that I still have.
Okay.
As a result of an incident that happened outside a takeaway. And then that was the turning point where things just the show started to be about what had happened that year.
Okay.
And that was probably the arc of it to date. Is the third year was more stuff that happened in my life that year. And the next year was about preparing to get married. And the next year was about the baby.
Yeah.
And what happened there. And then last year was about living with that baby.
Okay.
And this year is obviously going to be about moving here. So that's been the arc of the subject matter. What were you going to ask?
I was going to ask, do you feel that Edinburgh, as you mentioned earlier on, that you said due to the fact that you've done seven Edinburgh shows, you're getting work, you're in demand over here. Yeah. Has that been, let's talk about the relative successes of Edinburgh. So have you been, thing one, have you been getting people in through the door? Have you been breaking even? When did you start breaking even?
Well, my first year, I started to flyer the show myself, and it's probably something I'm quite proud of, and that I've heard comics go, I don't know, it looks terrible if you're flyering your own show. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard people say that.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
It looks awful, man. It's awful. I've never held that attitude. I've always, and probably a benefit of the way we are, the way we are, is that I would go out and meet them beforehand, and I'd have a chat with each and every one of them. And by year two, it was always full, as a result of the flowering, specifically. Mm-hmm. So people started coming off the street. Like, I'd do a check at the start, and it was usually 80% of them were flyered people.
By you?
By me. And so then it probably stopped being that expensive to do. Now, whether that produced work or not, because those tend to be like oldies, so people
walking around,
they're not industry folk. It probably didn't really produce a whole lot of work in the first 3 years, 4 years. I also was growing the show in Ireland. You're growing it in a completely foreign environment.
Yes.
Audiences in Ireland are vastly different to audiences here.
Okay.
You've done the laughter, right? Yes, you've seen it. The common factor Irish audiences have, I find, is every single man in that audience thinks he's funny too.
Yes.
And that, you know, well, if I was given the opportunity, I would obviously be doing this myself.
Yes, sure.
So you kind of have to give them that credit of, well, you're obviously mad, like you're crazy funny yourselves. So the shows, for a start, literally as a baseline, that's where you're growing it from. Whereas here, there's a history of stand-up, cabaret. It's part of your history. People have grown up with it. They're ready to come in, sit down and watch a show. They want to watch a show. You're the comic, you be funny.
Yeah.
So growing it in that environment and taking them over was probably the biggest challenge of those first 4 years.
Okay.
Because there were times, on no exaggeration, I'd have to chop a half an hour and write a new half an hour and put it in the show. And that just was just ridiculously hard.
Sure.
And you're walking through mud the whole way through the festival.
Of course.
So this is the first year that I've written one here.
Okay.
For English people.
Okay. written for the Scotland. English. Yeah, in Scotland. Yeah, for the English in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So after about year four, do you feel that there's been a tipping point in terms of your audience? Do you feel there's been a tipping point in terms of people coming back, you growing an audience? Or is it still sort of hand to mouth in that respect?
I still flyer for 2 hours before the show.
Yeah.
And I know that if I didn't do it, their numbers would be low. That said, there's people that come back every year.
Okay.
There are people that come back every year. I don't know. How do you measure this shit? Like, really? Sure. You just gotta hope that something. But like I say, the difficulty I was running into was that you weren't around enough. You weren't around enough for anybody to establish any kind of a relationship with you in this country. So, you'd go back up and start from scratch again.
Yeah.
And it was gutting. It was really gutting the first week up there. You'd be like, here I am again, fucking plodding around with a wad of flowers in my hands, all over. But something good comes of it. You got to get better, right?
Okay.
You don't get worse at comedy.
No, sure.
Somebody told me last night you do. Dom Herrera has a podcast from The Laugh Factory. You ever listen to that?
I've heard it once or twice.
He repeats it again and again and again that Michael Jordan will never be the basketball player he was.
Yes.
But we, if we keep going,
yeah,
we'll just keep getting better. And that's amazing.
Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. The jury's out on that one for me. I don't know that's a hard and fast rule.
Depends what you do, obviously. If you're, to extend the sport analogy, if you're just lifting the one dumbbell every day.
Sure. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Arm. Okay. With that caveat. Yeah. Yeah.
You got to work out properly and go and do your shows and do your 20 minutes. I think then we will continue to get better, and that's an amazing thing to me.
So
that's probably what I kept telling myself going up there for those years.
Yes.
Cause look, I'm not well known. I'm not rich. This is just a little house. We're just trying to figure it out. Get there. Get wherever it there is.
And have you got good relationships now with a lot of UK clubs? Are your weekends busy? Are you?
Yeah, my diary is good.
Yeah.
My diary is very good now. But I spent a year over here, back and forth, 2 weeks here, 2 weeks in Ireland.
Gotcha, okay.
And Joe Wilkinson would stay in his house.
Yeah.
And he was incredibly kind to me for the past 2 years or so, where I just stay at his place and go gigging and trying to pick up spots here and there. And just try and push the doors. I mean, I did what open spots do.
Yeah.
And I probably had the benefit of those years and those little bits and pieces and things to go, well, he's not an open spot. He's doing this and he's going to try here.
You can do that thing that sometimes Canadians come over and blitz it and then it doesn't stick. Because it doesn't have that repeat kind of quality. You can be a headliner somewhere else and turn up. No one's going to give you a headline slot straight away, exactly. And it will take time for that to filter in.
Yeah, so that's probably what my last 2 years have been. And they've been the hardest 2 years of my life, no question.
Really?
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Whilst bringing up Mikey?
Whilst attempting to bring up little Michael. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole nother area that you probably don't want to get into.
What else would you mean? Fatherhood and comedy?
No, well, he nearly died. And she nearly died in the birth.
Okay.
And I wrote a show about it. And it was probably the only time I'll ever write a really personal show just about what that was. Because at the time I was hosting some bullshit kids program on RTE to try and pay for it.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, you're surrounded by all this vacuous kind of fucking nonsense of kids TV. You can imagine being in that for 24 hours a day and then having to go to the hospital at night for 12 weeks not knowing what's going to fucking happen. So somehow I tried to extract comedy from it. On certain nights, people would say, you didn't do it.
Okay.
But on other nights, it was the most exhilarating show I've ever done.
So let's zero in on that then. How do you get the funny out of something like that? What kind of strategies were you using to it? Now, I didn't see that show, and I regret that I missed that one. But
well, I probably like tragedy and time is it's a cliche.
Sure.
I probably didn't give it enough time because the longer that went by, the easier it was to look back and extract.
Okay.
From it.
Okay.
So if people are going, people are listening to this or going, well, I've been through a lot of stuff. A lot of the time, I think that it's actually hindsight with a little bit of distance. You start to be able to draw stuff from it. It had literally just happened for me. So I was very much trying to draw on it right there in front of me, which was really hard. So you're doing a lot of long form writing. Because you're trying to work it out in your head. And then trying to pull as many bits from diaries and notebooks that you kept at the time.
Okay.
And then trying to form a cohesive structure and arc to the story.
Sure.
To make people hook in and listen to it.
Sure.
So it's a very complicated process.
Sure. But see, in terms of the arc of that story, at the end, it's got a happy ending. Mm-hmm. They both survived.
Yeah.
But other than that, what are you, like, when you were looking at that thinking, I'm going to talk about this, were you deciding, I mean, were there bits of it that you were telling friends socially that were making people laugh? Because, I mean, it sounds harrowing. Okay, so it sounds like you made the decision, you went, I'm going to turn this into stuff somehow.
Yeah, I don't know, man, if I ever made that decision of stuff, because it probably was why it was so hard to perform.
Sure.
I mean,
it wasn't composed of bits that you would do at comedy clubs. It was his own hour show.
Yeah. And it was just in the that ball in your throat through the show.
Yeah.
So like, it's not healthy to do it. I was doing the story to tell that had happened to me, and if I didn't tell it, it'd never tell it. That's the way I saw it.
Okay.
So I was just like, booking in previews around Dublin and doing it and trying to tell it as best I could, and each night just trying to work it out a little bit better, listen back, change something, move something else somewhere, try and inject some light where light is needed.
Okay.
And see what came out at the end. Like, I'm really proud of it, but it is one of those shows where if somebody came on the wrong night, they just go, this shit. You know, because it wasn't a club set.
Okay.
It wasn't an hour club set. It was a dynamic, a kind of constant state of flux piece that if you got it on the right fucking day, great stuff.
How does that sit with this idea that you want them to like you and you want to make them happy? That seems to me to have
it didn't sit well.
But you were able to persevere through that feeling.
Did, yeah. And probably the late night shows got me through that in Edinburgh that year, because I was just going around doing regular sets then, and they were just kind of lifting me out of it and taking me away from it, because you're forced to relive this shit in a show like that.
Yeah.
I never thought I would write a show like that, but then it just was written and it was happening, and by the time it was happening, it was too late, it was there, that's it. How does it sit with it? I mean, those people going to it who were expecting the same kind of, you know, upbeat kind of nonsense about cats and dogs.
Yeah.
And who were going, what the fuck is this? Why are we listening to this guy going on about his baby? I felt that if you got through the fact that, okay, you may have an image of this or expectation of this, once you get through that and actually sit there and listen rather than expecting like jokety joke Jokerson.
Sure.
Sure. It was a lot more wholesome than a kind of bag of sweets that I was doling out year on year.
Do you feel that there was any sense that comedy owed you the space to talk about that, because you've been doing bags of sweets for a long time?
Yeah, well, Tina said that. My wife was like, I think if you were better known, they would have let you have it.
Okay,
that's what she said.
Sure.
But I don't agree with that. I think if you just do it well, I'm very much like, yeah, if it's good.
So you don't feel, ultimately, you don't feel like that show was a success?
On a personal level, it was. Because, you know, for me, it was what had to be done. And,
sure,
like, it probably was that moment where you separated yourself from trying to please them.
Yeah.
To going, right, well, we're going to do this show. And the people that it spoke to, it really, really spoke to more than any bag of sweets would.
Yes, yes, okay.
And the people that it didn't speak to just kind of shrugged their shoulders and walked out.
Sure.
So, you know, from that sense, I mean, financially, I probably lost a fortune. But what the fuck are you going to do? Everybody loses money up there, right? Right?
Sometimes I get too... I do get too obvious with a moment. I'm thinking, that's a lovely moment to leave that particular thought.
Yeah.
And guests that have listened will then lead in with an impression of one of the stings. So let's talk about the way that you make the stuff.
Yeah.
So you were doing one-liners to begin with.
Yeah.
In the
that
early
was
days.
What I actually did one-liners all the way to the So You Think You're Funny final and BBC New Comedy Award final. I was just one-line guy.
Okay.
And that was what got me there. And then I had that moment of them not working and me going, well, what do I do now?
So
it's exceptionally hard to write one-liners.
And it's so time-consuming, so inefficient.
So really much work goes in, yeah. I mean, I actually heard Jerry Seinfeld recently say that if he allowed himself to curse, he could turn out a new hour every month.
Yeah, right.
Because the time and labour that goes into his stuff is so vast.
Yes, much easier to put fuck on the end to get off.
I wonder, I'd love to see Jimmy Carr do a talky conversational show.
Yes.
He has it in him.
Like, yes, absolutely.
As a very engaging storyteller, I'd love to see somebody like that do an hour about what's going on. So I started doing those, and
when you were making those, how were you approaching those? Was that like Dimitri Martin style, flicking through a dictionary and just attacking a word for a couple of hours, or what was it?
In a way, yeah, I would start with a funny line and write a setup for it, and I would just harvest through books and things and just write loads of stuff about it and try and just pluck little non sequiturs from it. I mean, really, really hard. 99% of it is shite. I don't know if maybe that's just my hit rate, but if you have any kind of standard for them, one-liners are ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I was doing that for ages, and probably it suited the situation. Being in an office,
showing
a job.
Yes.
Word document open at all times.
Yes.
And run away.
Yes, yes.
So that was how it all started there. And then, it's kind of a long time ago. There was, it does seem like quite a while back, but I definitely took a break. It definitely took 6 months. I can remember Maeve Higgins was a contemporary at the time. We really kind of started at the same time. And she couldn't believe that I was stopping for any amount of time because you kind of got to keep going.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
You just lose your place in the queue or whatever. And I think in that time of taking the time off, that was when I started to write more about my family.
Okay.
What my opinions and shit.
And when you were doing those, you said your first Edinburgh show, nothing was actually physically written down.
No.
Were you just kind of telling the same stuff on stage and picking your way through it each night, just remembering it, or were you?
Yeah, I guess I was doing a lot of emceeing at the time, so I'd have bits and pieces and bits and bobs and little bits in newspaper that I'd had picked out, something that I'd analyse, an article on stage, and add a story about the dog that I used to own. And yeah, it was literally all the bits and pieces thrown into an hour.
Sure.
And that was it. Yeah, that's what the first show was.
Okay.
I don't know if this is going to be really boring for your listeners or whatever.
Like, stop worrying about it.
Nobody gives a shit, Jar.
But no, they do. They all do. They all do.
Yeah, well, that was the first year. And
okay, so what changed then? What actually propelled you into...
I think you start looking at it as... You start to become a little bit more professional about it, don't you? After a little while, you start to be like... I think as well as that, after that first year, everybody has this experience of throwing that out. This thing that Louis C.K. thinks is so amazing that he's throwing out his old material
again. Sure.
It really fucks me off every time I hear that. I'm just like, what? Everybody over here does that, like every year.
Yes.
I don't know why this is such a big deal. And it's always like I'll say it to Louis if I ever meet him. It's like, it's always said in these self-aggrandizing terms of, I throw it out. Like,
yeah,
big fucking Mickey swing.
Yeah.
Really and truly. Every fella here is doing the exact same thing, and that's probably the moment when you start going, right, gonna write some chunks. You nearly have to clear the pipes, get all that shit out the first year. And for some people, it wins them an award because they didn't go up there for 4 years. But I kind of went straight up the second I was like, right, I'm doing this.
Okay.
It was kind of the way of the Irish at the time was, you gotta take an Edinburgh show up, and it was like, oh, not ready. Yeah, you are. Go.
Yeah.
So nobody hangs around. There isn't that sense of, I'll do a double up, I'll do a compilation show. You just go with your
first
bit of shit.
Okay.
And away you go.
Okay.
Well, after that, the pipes are cleared and you start writing bits.
Sure. So what environment do you ordinarily write then? Are you a sit down at an office guy or are you?
I used to be big time. I would get up at, my wife would leave at 7 and I would get up and sit at the desk from usually like 8 or 9 through to 1.
Okay.
And go. And then have a break and come back around 3 and go again.
Wow.
And wait till she got home and then be like, what are we doing? And she'd be like, well, I'm bollocks, so I don't want to do anything. So then out for a gig and try and work it out. That was that real period that I think a lot of comics have where it's your life and you're just fucking living. You're just all about boring people talking about comedy non-stop. And then I suppose other things happen and you start to be like, right, well, maybe that's not the wisest way to write this stuff.
Sure. The problem I struggle with when I sit down and do a load of sit-down writing is that I end up writing a script that I'm fine-tuning and cutting and pasting and moving stuff around and almost making work for myself to fill the time.
Yeah, well, definitely that kind of period taught me that thing of, you can write it all, you can write all you like, but then you got to take it up and see how it's hung in the tongue. If the tone will dictate, and your rhythm and tone will decide how it's actually going to be said.
Yes,
this is a suggestion on the page, but also at that time, kind of sitting down helps you, make actual things.
Like, yes,
that was how my books came about, and that's how I got a TV show out of my first Edinburgh show. I made a TV show about it. Irish television.
Oh, this
was totally through sitting down.
This was the one about no one knows.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So it was a kind of documentary about going to the festival and green as the day is long. Like, I look at her and I'm like, oh my God.
But that's a very ballsy thing to have gone, I'll do a movie ballsy about me going and doing it for the first time.
Is a substitute word for stupid in a lot of cases. Like, I really didn't, I'm not saying I was thick, but it was just like naive to go along with a lot of it. Like, a lot of the show was kind of dictated to me as I guess how it's going to happen, even though I'd written the idea.
Sure.
I'd come up with an idea of going to the Fringe and filming it, making a documentary about it, and parallel I would pose as my own agent, wear a costume and try and blag my way into things.
Okay.
And running alongside that, I would interview as many people as I could, and I did. I interviewed loads of comics about, you know, how do we do this? How do we get in here, and how does this work, and what's the best way to do well in Edinburgh? And I'll always have that show, that three episodes, but Jesus, I look at it, I'm like a baby, like a real comedy baby.
Okay.
In that show. So that show probably came about sitting down and writing a lot.
And you have one of your bits that I remember most was you on the phone to your dad.
Yeah.
Trying to talk him through doing the video
player.
Which is, you know, arguably it's a bag of sweets in that it's like a nice, sweet bit, but it's very, very funny. And it's got something that you're very good at, which is a sort of understated, you're quite subtle on stage. And I mean that as a compliment. It's quite deft, and you're very good at kind of, not exactly characterization of other people, but almost characterization of yourself. You're very, very measured, and this beat and that pause and dad.
No, I'm definitely really proud of that bit.
Yeah.
It's probably the first bit that I wrote where I was like, yeah, I could really be proud of that.
Sure.
That Barry Katz guy said that every comedian, and you should look up Barry Katz.
Yes, yeah, I will.
I don't know if people are familiar with Barry Katz. He's like, he's kind of a weird person to kind of stumble across, but he's an agent, and he's pretty well respected. He's been involved with some of the biggest names in American comedy over the last 25 years, and he kind of started out in Boston representing people like Dennis Leary when they were very, very much nobodies. Mm-hmm. But I listened to a podcast with Jay Moore, who he still represents, and his advice to new comics, when Jay asked him what would be the one tip you give, his was to take all your jokes and write each one on a post-it note with a key word, and put all of the bits, everything you are currently doing in your set, on a wall, and ask yourself honestly, which of those bits could you perform in front of your comedy hero and be proud of, and be kind of confident that they would look at you positively for doing that bit.
Mm-hmm.
He said, keep those bits and bin the rest. We never really talked about reviews, did we, before?
No.
But sometimes I feel like a lot of reviews are judging comics on the one standard. Tom Gleason talked to me about this, that he had a very frank discussion with a certain reviewer who gets mentioned constantly on your show.
Okay.
And he said to him, you're judging my show on the basis that it's an Edinburgh show, but I never go to Edinburgh, so it's not really fair of you to judge it on those standards. And that can be said of a lot of things, I think, in comedy. And I probably regret saying that in the first part of this, that I think that there's that, you know, it's either funny or it's not. No, I think sometimes they need to be shown that this is funny. And sometimes the audience isn't wise, and that maybe you need to grow up for a while in that persona or along that path, and they'll eventually follow.
Do you feel confident now that you can show an audience something is funny?
I don't know, Stu. I'm trying. I think that the second you start to go, oh, I could do that, you know, I think that you need a certain amount of fear. I remember Josh talking about that on the show, just the fear of God that's in you, that it's going to be shit.
Yeah.
Like, you can't really swagger around. I've heard
Is that what we've got to look forward to? No matter how good we get, no matter how well, just how good we get. No matter how able we are, no matter how experienced we are, what we have to look forward to is still being nervous and still... I mean, do you...
Yeah, well, I think definitely the approach is really... take for example, Stuart Lee. His persona, the persona, and it is clear and distinct persona,
yeah,
of this curmudgeonly comedian who feels the world owes him a living, mm-hmm, and he's been overlooked. And it's such a funny character that's within Stuart Lee that now is kind of jarring with where he is in terms of respect.
Sure.
Because a lot of people don't get that, oh, that's a character, Stuart Lee. That, you know, there is that thing of, but he's doing really well. How, yes, can he carry off this character? He's playing his huge... He doesn't have to work for the rest of his life. And the same with Ricky Gervais. It's like, you know, for a while it was funny. Oh, a couple of AFTAs, a little look to the side. And then, you know, it doesn't match up after a while. It's like, no, you're really successful.
Sure.
That our thing that we have to look forward to is that you... like, it's got to come from the bottom. It can't come from the top. You can't be making jokes standing on the top of the mountain about life down below.
Sure, I absolutely agree with you, but I want to bring this back to you and talk in a more specific way about your own experience. I mean, what are you anticipating happening in the future of your career? What sort of level would you like to get to? What do you think is attainable for you? And what do you think is maybe something that... I mean,
is there any...
Sorry, say again?
This is full disclosure.
Yeah.
My career, and I don't like and I hate talking about career with comedy because, you know, that's the strings, isn't it? You have to kind of appear like there's an extent that people don't want to know or give a shit.
Sure.
That there's a life behind it. They want to feel that you rocked into the room and I got on stage and said the shit's just coming to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I know what you mean. Yeah.
So this is jarring for you to talk about and for certain people to listen to. But the reality and the position of myself and my life at the moment is that I probably went through a period in Ireland where things got to a certain level. And there appeared to be a glass ceiling, mm-hmm, that I couldn't break through without some form of TV that probably was available in 2008 and 2009. But when the market fell out and Ireland just crumpled to its knees economically, I come here now to England and pretty much start from the bottom up, like pretty much start from nothing, go back to zero,
yeah,
and start trying to put houses on whatever Monopoly board it is that we're playing on,
sure,
whatever clubs each street is. You're just trying again in a new place. And that is incredibly humbling, I'll be honest with you, because there is a coziness that you feel when you go to places like New Zealand. And
yes,
among the comics, that they're like, well, you know, I play the classic every weekend. And it's like, there is a, you know, things are going okay for me. I'm making money off jokes.
Sure.
But you come to London and you come to the UK and there's a whole new ladder. There's a whole new world. And that is the kind of the chat that isn't very sexy in terms of comedy.
Sure.
But I am starting from scratch, despite the fact that I've got 6 Edinburgh shows under my belt.
Sure.
And I am not too proud to go and do the open spot, if that's what it takes, and show that I've got at least 10 minutes of stuff.
Sure.
Because for me, all I'm trying to do and all I ever want to do with this is to reach the most amount of people that agree with me as to what is funny. That is it. And I really don't think that that's a million miles away from what anyone is at with this, whether they're Stuart Lee, Tim Key, David O'Doherty, Dylan Moran, Russell Howard or Dane Cook. Mm-hmm. You just want to find like-minded people,
mm-hmm,
who get what you get. Surely you've had a moment where you're like, fuck this, no way, how could this
mate,
be?
Yes, me personally, yes, all the time.
I think that'd be an amazing realm to delve into in each interview, Because every comic worth his salt has surely experienced a moment where he thought, well, even for a split second, fuck this.
Yeah.
Am I going to really do this? Is this it? That's a question that, you know, as much as Michael Legg likes to dismiss deep conversation about what it is that we do, you know Michael Legg has been there. He's definitely had that conversation with himself.
Sure.
And it's fascinating, isn't it? It's like that end of things where you question your ability to go on.
Yeah, and
it's the basis of every great movie out there about comeback stories and sports. Without that you can't really fully appreciate it, any kind of contentment or pleasure from it. You have to certainly, anyone who's had it easy, anyone who people talk about
getting it easy,
particularly Ricky Gervais talking about how, well, I never really struggled in the clubs, like that's kind of haunted him. I think there's a sense that it was certainly for a while, maybe not now, I don't know who he is now, but he's some people who haven't had a kind of real struggle have difficulty squaring the circle of their success, I think, at a certain point.
Sure. Yes, I think that's certainly true.
Don't know how interesting that is for the podcast, but...
No, that's all good. Hey, we're still rolling. This is all good. I just wonder, finally, then, what's the connection between getting to a stage where you are thinking, possibly, fuck this, and... like you were saying before, that thing of like your comedian always wants to give the impression that they've just rocked up to a club and, hey, this is all easy.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if we could maybe tie this in somehow with what we talked about being a nice guy, and whether or not there's the, you know, if you do get permission to go to deeper places. Like, could you imagine ever saying to an audience, I've considered quitting comedy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know why? Because I see... the greats do it. I mean, that thing of that I mentioned of, you want to there is a certain mask that a certain type of audience or audience member wants. They do not want to know about the struggle of being a comedian. They just want to feel that I'm here with the funny guy, mm-hmm. having the laughs. Mm-hmm. But the greats, the true greats that are regarded as the standard bearers for what it is that we do, have all managed somehow to penetrate that subject of struggle and real darkness in your life. And I very much include Jerry Seinfeld in that. This whole thing of your life sucks, obviously my life sucks a little bit less than yours, but it's such a he goes there that, like, we are not as good as we think we are. Dylan Moran, you never have your potential is like your bank account. Never look at it, because you always have less than you think. It is that penetrating with those kind of lines is the true challenge, isn't it? That, like, being, feeling that, I can do my stuff about supermarkets, and as hard as that subject is, equally as hard, because it's been done so much.
Sure, absolutely.
But that is the challenge. That's why there's so many people trying to do it, I think, is because it appears easy, but it's only after you invest 10 years that you realize this is really hard. But should I do it and it come off? That sense of achievement must be immense.
So just tell us quickly about your Edinburgh show.
Very quickly, 5:15. At the Assembly Rooms on George Street, the sister venue of The Stand. It's called DiGiarlo Unchained. And it's an hour of stand-up that I think people will like. Yeah, it's the opposite of Tom Gleason there. I think people are going to like it.
So that was Jarlath. I've got some blinding guests coming up over the next couple of weeks. It's just a case of how many I get to before Edinburgh, because I'm getting pretty busy with the pre-Edinburgh admin and all the surrounding admin of promoting the show and researching the guests and stuff like that. But thank you very much to Jarlath, especially. He was so honest. He was so candid. Those are always my favourite ones. He's such a lovely bloke. And he was also, he apologised to me for my sound file corrupting and me having to ring him back on Skype a week later. But I'm very glad I did, because we got some really good stuff there. So thanks to him. Thank you, as ever, Dan Melrose and Graham Crockford. And thank you to Ben Lund Conlon, who, as you know, is my skivvy. He's the ComCom podling and is doing some excellent work for me. So thanks, Ben. Thank you, the listener. Share it. If you like it, share it. That's all I'm asking. See you soon.
I hope that's good stuff and it's not too highfalutin.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.